Richard, last week, Linda Moulton Howe interviewed astronomers about Comet Elenin. NASA has been publicly saying too much internet stuff. Don't worry about it. Nothing's going to happen. What's your take on this?
Well, I started out thinking that this was a lot of hoopla over absolutely nothing. I mean, when you look at when Leonid Elenin discovered this thing, which was back on December 10th of 2010, it looked like a perfectly normal distant discovery 8-9 months ago of a little tiny bergy bit. I mean, we got hundreds that come through the solar system every year. If you look at the SOHO and STEREO data, you know, these NASA spacecraft that stare at the sun, you can see dozens every month plunging past the stations of those satellites and plunging into the sun. And they're spectacular, they're interesting, and they mean absolutely nothing. I mean, so I'm looking at all this hoopla, and it's like, well, why is there all this interest in this little absolutely piece of nothing? So because I'm a curious person and because I like numbers, you know, scientists work with numbers, I started looking at the JPL site and the ephemeris, which is posted daily, updated like it used to be updated every week. I haven't looked at it in the last few weeks because they stopped updating it because the orbit was so fixed from thousands of observations that basically this thing's not going to change now unless it does something really weird all the way out of the solar system after it turns around the sun on the 10th and 11th of this month, just a few days from now. So I start looking at these numbers, and I began to see a pattern, and it was something that I wasn't looking for. I didn't intend to find it. It was completely serendipitous. In the classic definition of that term, I started seeing this amazing ritualistic pattern of 19.5. And I will give you some examples.
All right.
I actually had made a file to bring to the studio last Friday night. I was going to lay these out so you could see them right in front of you on the desk.
Okay.
Because they're really impressive. So I'm going to have to now, for radio, walk through these, you know, on radio without the benefit of having them basically in front of you. So let's see how we can do.
Okay.
I started out looking at a place called the IAU Minor Planet Center, which is located up in Boston, actually in Cambridge. It used to be run by a dear friend of mine named Brian Marsden, who died recently. I mean, he was there for decades. He was like the institutional guy. He taught me more about asteroids and comets than anybody else could possibly on the planet. And when I was at the Hayden, and unfortunately he is now gone, like so many of our friends, George, we seem to be seeing people quietly going
away. We're getting older, Richard.
I guess
that's it.
Anyway, so I'm looking down through the earliest observations when Elenin himself, this Russian mathematician, who's really a kind of an avid amateur astronomer, and he was using a remote control observatory here in New Mexico, so the story goes, run by his computer there in Moscow, to discover this comet. And he's really tickled to death. And when you read his website, you know, he's preening himself and he's happy and he's delighted because it's such an ego boo. I mean, what other thing in life, George, do you get to name after yourself that is basically the sign in the heavens for when kings and princes die, that kind of thing?
That's right.
So there's this comet up there with his name on it. And I'm looking down through the tables that the IAU Minor Planet Center publishes, and I look at this number, and it's, wait a minute, that can't be. He discovered it. Elenin discovered this thing when it was 19.5 magnitude? Okay. And I'm looking at the table right now. He took four plates, four CCD images, all of them 19.5. The next guy to take images and dump them into the system a couple nights later, it was 19.1.
And take just a quick minute, Richard, and explain to some people who are brand new to the show what this means when you say 19.5.
Well, we don't have the time. If you want to take calls in the last half hour, we do not have time. You have to go to my website.
Well, give us a highlight.
All right. If you take a tetrahedron, which is the simplest three-dimensional structure you can have in space-time, 3D, and you rotate it, just spin it in space.
All right.
A tetrahedron is an equilateral triangle, four of them pasted together. I'm sorry, three of them. and it has four sides, four vertices, four corners.
Like a pyramid.
It's basically a four-sided pyramid. But the fourth side is not on the bottom, it's on the side. The pyramids in Egypt are really five-sided. You know, they got four sides on each side, and then they're sitting on the fifth.
That's right.
So this is a classic. It turns out Bucky Fuller's work was all based around tetrahedral systems. It turns out a tetrahedron is the simplest three-dimensional object that you can create in three-dimensional space. It's the first eruption out of the plane or a line, that kind of simple geometry. It turns out if you put it in a sphere and you rotate the sphere and you put one of the points, one of the vertices on either the north or south pole, like a planet, let's say the Earth, the other three vertices will pop up either inside the northern or southern hemisphere, depending on where that fourth vertices is located, at either 19.5 degrees north or 19.5 degrees south.
Okay.
And when you look at planets, even the sun, energy eruptions on rotating celestial objects all across the universe, stars, planets, all the ones we can see in this system, the major eruptions, the major energy upwellings are at 19.5 degrees, give or take. I mean, physics is never exact. It's like a margin, like a range, like a window. So it's kind of 19.5. Actually, the precise mathematical definition is 19.47, but we always round it to 19.5.
Okay, so the fact that you could even get close to it with a lot of things that you have talked about over the years is pretty remarkable.
It's impossible. So I start looking, let me riffle through my sheet here, all right? What I tried to do then is I started looking at these numbers, and the 19.5s kept popping up. I said, okay, how do I put this in a statistical format to where I can actually calculate the probability that this whole thing is just by chance? And what you do with probabilities, you take the probability of any individual coincidence, and then you multiply it by the probability of the next coincidence. Probabilities don't add, they multiply, which means if you have a string of improbable things that happen, bing, 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 run, one right after another, the end of that string can really grow enormous very, very quickly. So I'll give you the kind of logic of how I did this first thing. How do I decide what the probability of Leonid Elenin discovering Comet Elenin at 19.5 magnitude would be by simple chance? Well, the brightest comet ever observed by astronomy was Ikea Seki in 65. That was 17th magnitude, minus 17. The dimmest comet ever observed is Halley with Hubble in 2003, as it's moving way out toward the outer part of its orbit now after passing close to us in 1986. That's at plus 28.2 magnitude. So the total range is 45.2 magnitudes. So the chance odds of discovering a comet at magnitude 19.5, that's plus 19.5, is 1 in 45.2.
Okay.
Okay? I mean, nothing to write home about. You take those odds to Vegas, you might win some money. So here's the next one. If you multiply... Let me get this in sequence here.
All right.
The odds of Elenin actually visiting the Earth in any one period of time, in other words, any one particular day, is basically 1 in 365, right?
Should.
Why is the closest approach on September 11th? Not the 9th, not the 12th. But the 10th and 11th. Now, why is it also the 10th? Because it starts in one part of the Earth, and then as the spacecraft moves around the sun, it's closest to the sun for a slice of the Pacific, a portion of the Earth, on September 11th. Now, September 11th, as we know historically, 10 years ago, was a hugely important date. But just forget that it's historically important. Just say, what are the odds that on any particular day, that there would be something occur? Well, the odds are 1 in 365, right?
That's right.
So you have to multiply that 19.5 odds I just gave you, which is 1 in 45.2, by 365. Okay? Now, if you pin it down to the fact that it's the 10th anniversary, It's not 9 years. It's not 12 years after our 9/11.
It's 10.
Horrified us. You have to multiply that by 10. You see how this rapidly begins to escalate up? So let me move through my view graphs here. Okay.
But are these not numbers that people have created.
Oh, no.
They're
no,
there,
no.
Right?
They are what they are. They are in the ephemeris. They're in the orbit of the comet. Okay, let me give you the last one that's really amazing. Well, two last ones. Elenine approaches closest to the Earth on October 16th. Remember, it's now approaching the sun. It'll turn around the sun in a hairpin turn. That's the way gravity mm-hmm. and Kepler's laws work on the 10th, 11th.
And then here it comes.
And then it'll be moving toward the Earth. We're moving toward it. It will cross our bow 22 million miles away on the evening of October 16th at 19 hours 50
minutes. Oh, come on.
No, serious, right in the ephemeris. You start looking at this. Okay, let me give you what the odds are now that we're up to. The odds of all these coincidences being just coincidence.
I hate that word.
I know. We have now exceeded, where's my view graph go here? Hold on one.
All right.
Okay.
We're talking about Comet Elenin with Richard C. Hoagland. There is a method to his madness.
All right. The odds now are up to 230 million to one against chance.
With all those 19.5s.
With all those 19.5s. But I'm not done. Remember at Ronco, the guy says, but there's more.
Yeah.
Okay. Elenine is listed by JPL as a hyperbolic comet.
What does that mean?
It means it's never been here before and never will be here again.
It's gone.
It's gone. It's a one of. You know, it's a one of a kind. In fact, what's so bizarre, if you start doing some study of astronomy, in the entire history of astronomy, George, there has never been a hyperbolic comet recorded and verified by all of astronomy ever.
Now, how do they know it's not going to come around in 200 years?
Well, but remember, they can calculate the orbit based on positional plots using, you know, Kepler's laws, Newton's laws, gravity. We know what's up beyond the inner solar system. We know that it doesn't go anywhere near close to the other stars. So the orbit is pretty well defined, particularly after it comes through. We'll know exactly when, if it ever comes back again, it's going to come back again. And it turns out that number is around 11,800 years. But coming in, JPL, NASA, has been insisting from day one, this is a hyperbolic comet, meaning it's an interstellar visitor with an inclination to the orbit of the Earth of 1.84 degrees. So I look at that and I say, what are the odds that a random interstellar visitor, never seen before in the history of astronomy, which goes back hundreds of years, right?
Right.
Will have that specific inclination. And I do a simple calculation. There are 360 degrees in a circle, right?
Yep.
You simply divide 360 by 1.84. Now, if you could follow along at home, folks, with your calculator, and George, if you had a calculator there in the studio, you'd now be falling on the floor because the number that the calculator will spit out...
It's not big enough.
195. You have one chance in 195 of that coming up by chance. You multiply that by the 200-plus million I just gave you for the previous odds, we're now up to one chance in 45 billion, with a B, that this thing is accidental. In other words, all of these orbital parameters, the numbers, not me, the numbers say, with a statistical, you know, certitude, you could take to Vegas and own the world if this was on your side, that 45 billion to one, this thing has been designed. The orbit is not random. The orbit is as precise as NASA sending the Cassini spacecraft to Saturn.
Are you saying it's a craft of some type?
It is something. This is where I was several weeks ago. It's something which was sent to us with these specific parameters. Remember, If I go outside, George, in the winter, and you can't do that in Southern California, but in New England you can, and I roll up some snow and I throw it at somebody else, that is a specifically designed trajectory.
Right.
A fastball in Fenway Park is a specifically designed trajectory. The ball is manufactured. The snowball is just natural stuff. But the trajectory, the orbit, has been defined by an artificial intelligence, i.e. a human being.
Sent this way.
So whether Elanine, remember we're talking where I was weeks ago in my thinking, was natural or artificial, meaning it was just a comet or it was a spacecraft, was irrelevant because the numbers prove someone sent it.
Now, why?
Now we get to the weird dichotomy, which Elanine himself will not address, really. He's papering it over on his website. He pretends it doesn't exist.
Nor will NASA address this.
NASA, remember, Elanine discovered the thing, so he's been calculating its orbit separately from NASA. They're both using the same database. In other words, all over the world, there are astronomers, both amateurs and professional, who've been observing this thing night after night after night for the last 8 months, right, taking pictures.
Sure.
They feed them into this central clearinghouse, this database up at Harvard, the IAU Center. NASA takes those observations and calculates, using its computers, an orbit. Elanine, in Moscow, with his little laptop sitting out in a parking lot, he did a really cute interview with Russian television. I mean, he's a really nice guy, just a 30-year-old guy who's tickled to death. He's discovered a comet, and he hasn't a guile in the world. He's not in on a plot. He's not part of some super conspiracy. He's just really feeling cool. He's discovered a comet.
Yeah, he just found
it. Idea that something much bigger is apparently going on. He calculates that this orbit of this thing when he first found it was not forever, meaning hyperbolic. It was 13,000 years, meaning that's half the precessional cycle of 26,000, right?
That's right.
13,000 years is the last time of Atlantis. It's the last time of the fourth world of the Hopi, of the great transition 13 baktuns ago of the Mayan calendar. It's the time of Zeptepi and the ancient Egyptians. It's the last time human beings had really high-tech, cool stuff on this planet in the model until something very bad happened and we lost it all. We lost almost all those people, and we've been climbing back up the ladder to try to reach for the stars again after 13,000 years. Well, what are the odds, you're going to get tired of me saying this, that this thing, with all these other parameters, could be exactly 13,000 years from the last catastrophe of the Earth?
One in a zillion?
It's so big that there probably isn't a computer on the planet that could handle it, George. That's why I can say categorically tonight to everybody hanging, I hope, on the edge of their chair, looking at their radios like we used to do when I drove home with my parents from the supermarket.
Gathered around with your family.
Yeah, it is artificial. Elanine is artificial, regardless of whether it's a rock, a comet, or a spaceship.
That it was sent this way.
By an intelligence. Now, my model, which I've discussed on the show before, it is us who sent it. It's our great, 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 great grandmothers, the folks who survived that last catastrophe, that last huge Atlantean descent into the primeval sea of nothing and oblivion when something awful happened, and they sent to their future descendants a time capsule or an ark or a library or something that would help us now in our time of greatest need, as the physics is conspiring to maybe, big maybe, create the circumstances that will do that same thing to the Earth again.
Richard, we're going to come back. We're going to continue talking. We'll try to take a few calls here with Richard C. Hoagland on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, split show for you for the first couple hours, Jim Mars joins us as we talk about his thoughts on how the media twists stories to their own benefit. And then later on, psychic and author Dr. Lewis Turry joins us on Coast to Coast, talking about the past and the present and the future. And when we come back, let's take some calls and continue talking with Richard C. Hoagland on Coast to Coast AM. So, Richard, if you think it was our ancestors who have basically launched this comet, what's their message? What do they want us to know?
Well, there are several possibilities for how we would get the message. One is they may have assumed that we would develop technology sufficient that we could go out, like in Arthur C. Clarke's wonderful classic Rendezvous with Rama, and actually rendezvous with Elenin, knock on it, enter some codes, go in the front door, and find everything we need to basically change history. However, as you know, that has not happened. The space program has been moribund for the last 40 years. We went to the moon. They killed Kennedy before that. And we've gone off in totally different directions to where there appear now to be two space programs, one run by an elite with real anti-gravity spaceships, the secret space program that we've talked about on this show many times, and the one using dumb rockets that appears to be coming to an end that wouldn't possibly get anywhere near Elenin because it's moving so fast as it whips around the sun and crosses our bow that you'd never even catch it with a rocket, let alone be able to rendezvous with it. The other possibility is that they were smart enough to realize that history might fragment and that bad guys would continue to take control of the human species, would monitor our calls, so to speak, you know, look at our email, you know, bring up things like the Patriot Act where they can, you know, wind up entering a poor kid's bedroom, 13 years old the other night, FBI guys rush in, all guns drawn, because they think he's part of Anonymous. So if our ancestors were smart enough to realize that history could be hijacked by a bunch of people that do not have the best interests of the rest of the human race at stake, they may have designed programs, protocols, into computers on board this thing, whatever it is, and they either could beam radio signals, laser signals, or they could be broadcasting on frequencies in the torsion field that we are not even equipped, except maybe for our Accutron measurements, to even detect. I am strongly recommending that any hams or radio astronomers listening start tuning in and pointing their antennas at Elenin, because it doesn't need to be seen to be picked up on radio or even on lasers. The other thing...
You wanted Seth to get some beaming over there.
I'd like Seth, who's gotten...
Shostak from SETI.
Seth Shostak to turn his antennas at Elenin. I mean, what's he got to lose? If he gets nothing, so what?
Oh, I agree. It doesn't cost him anything. No.
You know, I mean, I'm challenging... If he's listening tonight, Seth, come on, be a scientist. Listen, do an observation, and then tell us what you hear. If people want to know what frequencies... You know what the classic SETI paradigm has been for years, George? That we've been sending out radio signals, like I used to tell Walter Cronkite, that by the time he had finished the evening news, and then they did the 11 o'clock a tiny news feed on the network several hours later, his evening news was crossing the edge of the solar system, the orbit of Pluto, at the speed of light, every single night. So we've been broadcasting into interstellar space on radio and television wavelengths for decades. So I would start listening on those frequencies, channels 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, the old UHF and VHF channels, and some of the major ham bands that can get through the ionosphere. Somebody will pick up something if this model is correct and they're using something as primitive as radio or television. Frankly, I think that it's going to be a lot more spectacular. I think that they will set up a system where something happens visually, so that Elenin becomes, as a surprise, as a shock, as a kind of a ritualized resurrection, the Hopi blue star.
Now, what if that Norway spiral popped up at the same time?
Well, that could have been a forerunner of what we're going to see, couldn't it?
Maybe. Yeah.
And there are rumors now that Elenin is disintegrating. I mean, I've been seeing those over the internet.
But you're not a doom and gloomer about this comet.
Well, of course not, because I see too much incredible numerical precision into an incredibly uplifting message. George, what would you say would be the one thing that would free the human race forever from anyone trying to put us into chains? It would be the ultimate understanding of how the universe works, how to create free energy, anti-gravity, immortality. It would free us from elites and banksters and everybody who's picking our pocket and all the corruption we see going on now, once and forever, provided that message and that information got to the ordinary folks. It would be a stunning way to change history, and that's what my friend Arthur C. Clarke, I think, was trying to tell us in several of his stunning classics, not the least of which is Childhood's End. Remember how that book went?
That's a classic.
Incredible. Now, there's one other data point we have to hit before we go to calls.
All right.
I know we're running late on time, but if I don't do this, I'm going to kick myself in the morning. I sent you a couple of photographs a few days ago.
Richard,
right?
It is the morning.
And what did you see on the photos?
I saw a little tetrahedron.
Exactly. On the official NASA stereo B footage of the interaction a few days ago.
It looked like a floating pyramid.
It was the night that you and I were supposed to be in the studio here in Albuquerque. That night, Stereo B, which is one of these NASA solar spacecraft, took a sequence of video frames across millions of miles from Earth's orbit to about the orbit of Venus. That's the distance that Elenine was from the spacecraft that night, 23 million miles. And it photographed Elenine interacting with the solar wind, this spray of charged particles that's constantly blowing off the sun. And because of this ghostly impingement of this radiation in space around Elenine, suddenly a shape showed up, a geometric figure. Elenine appears to have a tetrahedrally shaped geometric, I mean, I can only call it a force field, which is interacting with the solar wind, with hydrogen and free protons and electrons that basically recombine to cause it to light up, kind of like glowing when it hits this screen. That shape, that geometry, is incredibly recursive of the geometry embodied in the trajectory. All those 19.5 numbers are now embodied in the shape of the field around this thing itself, meaning it's not just a Burgy bit. It cannot just be a comet. It has to be an actual ship with generators and computers and control, meaning it could do anything from here on. The dates to watch will be when it passes around the sun on the 11th, 9/11. When it is in conjunction with the Earth, which is on September 26th, which is the weekend, George, that you and I are going to be at Kerry Cassidy's Awake and Aware conference.
That's right. I'm going to be there Friday night. You're going to be there Friday and Saturday.
I'm going to be speaking Saturday night.
Yeah.
For several hours, laying out all of this data and so much more we haven't had time to get into, plus the NASA VESTA mission, which is doing amazing things out in the asteroid belt, which is part of the mega story, and I will be there at the conference all that weekend. If people want to get tickets, by the way, George, I should give people a number, because you can go to the web to awakenaware2011.com for everybody on the web, but we have a lot of the audience that don't have computers. If you want to join us, you simply call in Los Angeles 301-537-2194. That's 301-537-2194 for the Awake and Aware conference in Irvine, California, the weekend that Elenine crosses conjunction with the sun. And if all these numbers are correct, something extraordinary, something even hyperdimensional, could happen that very weekend.
All right, let's take some final calls here. But I do have to say, if you believe in extraterrestrial life, there's no reason not to believe that eventually, a huge spacecraft would come to our region, regardless of whether you think we're being visited or not right now. East of the Rockies, Joseph in Toronto, Canada. Go ahead, Joseph.
Hey, guys. I just wanted to say, first off, Richard is talking about free energy, and, we're running commercials in Ontario calling Shine On in a solar energy. And we're investing heavily in that, and we have a heavy investment in Samsung with wind power. But you also have to have a diverse market. So we're investing in natural gas. We're also investing still in nuclear. And
and what does this have to do with Elenine?
Well, I guess, that's just one thing I wanted to touch upon. You also talked about the Middle East. The Middle East right now is succeeding, and thank you to Hillary Clinton, Obama, the United Nations, the Security Council, because they have allowed 30 other nations. finally to stand up and say we want freedom.
Okay, there's your political stand. But just questions on Comet Elanine, west of the Rockies. Hello?
Hello?
Go ahead, Morgan.
Hey, guys. So I personally think that we are the complete representation of evolution, and that we are the highest form. But because we think we're so high, we think we can drive around in our luxury cars and just ruin what I believe we're living on heaven on earth, and this is heaven, and that we're just in, I mean, there's no way to say exactly what we are and why we're here, and that the only way to find it is to be free of all of our material possessions, and that, you know, if this is a God ship or a alien ship coming to point us or to destroy us, which I don't think it would unless we're living in a devil realm or a hell realm, which many of us are, and we are leading ourselves into hell. I mean, with all the carbon that we're emitting, just look at, like, I believe it's Jupiter. I could be wrong. It might be Mercury. But their planet is full of carbon. And guess what they have? 600 degree temperatures, solar storms, and just huge storms that will wipe out everything in their path. Do we want to live on a planet like that?
Well, no. Keep in mind, though, they're a little closer to their sun than we are. Much closer.
See, what people need to understand is we are living in an artificially enforced existence. We have a glass ceiling over us. We have been enforced to use fossil fuels, hydrocarbons, all kinds of very stupid things that are destroying the planet. If we were allowed the actual hyperdimensional physics that it was intended to have us function, none of this would be going on. This would be heaven on earth. It's artificially kept from being heaven. And ancestors, maybe our ancestors, in fact, are trying to show us the proper route, the proper way in time to save the earth before we kill it ourselves.
Next up, we go to Joe in Cypress, Texas. Welcome to the program, Joe. Go ahead.
Richard, you're 100% correct about them destroying the space station. It's what they did to the Titan Apollo project. It's what they did to the SR-71. These things have a useful lifespan to fill in a requirement for the elite to build certain items. And in this case, it's a time travel machine. Are you familiar with the Einstein-Gödel model of rotational universe?
Yes.
Read my article called Federally Funded Frankenscience. It's posted.
Send me a link on Enterprise, okay?
Yeah. Federally Funded Frankenscience. It's posted at Canada Free Press. It's one of a 10-article series on time travel. You'll flip.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
Woo, there he goes.
He beamed up.
So, November, they will tell the astronauts, come home.
Well, what's interesting that happens in November, and I find the coincidence, again, more coincidence, eerie. On November 11th, 11-11-11, Elanine aligns with the Earth, with Mercury, and Venus, all in an absolutely straight line within tenths of a degree. A couple, 3 days later, around the 23rd, I think, it aligns with Earth and the Sun. If there is a hyperdimensional generator on board this thing, if that's what's creating this weird geometry in the solar wind CME stream that we're seeing, then those alignment dates could, in fact, be very interesting and important in the physics, and there may be reasons in the ritual, some of these guys are obvious ritualists, why they would want to bring folks down and have them here on Earth and not in the space station when those key dates come, and who knows what might happen. I have, as remember that line in Star Wars where Luke says, I have a bad feeling about this? I don't have a fuzzy, warm feeling about abandoning something that's taken us 10 years and $100 billion to build just because of some damn pump in a booster, in a rocket, that has worked incredibly well hundreds of times.
Next up, we go to Robert in L.A. You're on Coast to Coast. Hey, Robert, go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was calling in to ask them about the ideas about the New Jerusalem in the Bible and the dimensions that are given in the Bible, and if that could even correlate with the shape of the lean coming this way. If you think most people might think that could be the New Jerusalem coming this way, or the kingdom of God. Are you familiar with that?
Well,
not really.
I don't think it'll be that. I wouldn't worry about that too much. Now, is the comet the blue star? Richard?
Well, I mean, that's one possibility. Remember, I said earlier, we're looking at scenarios. I don't necessarily believe any of these individual possibilities, but I'm laying them out there so people can pick and choose. Something is going to happen. One of these sets of probabilities is going to take place. The numbers say this thing has been designed, sent to us, obviously for some reason. We don't know for certainty what the reason is yet. We, hopefully, by the end of November, when these last alignments take place, we will know a lot more than we do now.
Richard C. Hoagland, our special guest. Let's take one more quick call. Ed in Detroit, squeeze you in. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Eddie.
Oh, this is Adam. I got one question to clear up. There's a researcher named Alex Retrov. He's talking about the researcher that discovered comet Elenin, Leonid Elenin. He said that's a fake researcher, and it's an acronym that stands for Elenin's coming from the constellation of Leo, National Institute of Defense, extinction level event near Impact Nibiru.
Okay, that's one thing I wouldn't worry about. That's the one thing that is on the internet, that comet Elenin is going to be catastrophic. Richard says no.
Well, it doesn't come anywhere closer than 22 million miles. How can you have a catastrophe when something is as far away as Venus?
It is far away indeed. Richard, thanks so much for being on the program. Our next show, split program, Jim Mars, Lewis Turry on Coast to Coast AM. For Nathan Staten, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.